Envision this. You're an internal medicine resident, and your roommate comes to you complaining of pain in her right leg. She's been moving into your apartment, carrying heavy boxes upstairs to your third floor space. Also, in preparation for the move, she'd been on her hands and knees cleaning the floors in her room. As you talk to her, you notice that she has her right leg elevated with an ice pack on it. I don't remember hurting it, but it looks like I have a red rubber ball on my knee. Is that blood? She says. As she lifts the ice pack to reveal the tense red swelling overlying her kneecap, she winces when you touch it, but she doesn't feel feverish. She says it doesn't hurt to walk on it, but she has pain when she bends her knee. You really want to help your roommate out, as she's in such discomfort. How will you describe the anatomy of her knee that may lead to an explanation of what's going on? Welcome to Audio Bricks. This is Ed Barnes breaking down tendonitis and bursitis in your ears. But first, a quick shout out to the learning platform that makes Audio Bricks possible, the RX Bricks, which is the source of all content you hear on this podcast. And if you've been holding off on checking this out, well, now we're running the Bricks Season Pass campaign. If you follow the link in the show notes below, you can get 3 months of Bricks for the price of one, or a full year of Bricks for the price of 3 months. And simply clicking on the link helps support Audio Bricks and the work we do to bring you the podcast. So we'll be happy if you just even take a look. After completing this section, you will be able to 1. Define tendonitis and bursitis and compare their epidemiology and causes. 2. Describe two common forms of tendonitis, rotator cuff tendonitis and lateral epicondylitis, and discuss their clinical presentations, diagnosis, and treatments. 3. Describe the three common forms of bursitis, shoulder bursitis, olecranon bursitis, and popliteal, or also known as Baker cysts, and discuss their clinical presentations, diagnosis, and treatment. People who play tennis or golf, or even those who get wrist or shoulder pain from working on their computers, likely are familiar with the pain around the joints of the upper extremity. Is it rotator cuff tendonitis or subacromial bursitis, tennis elbow, or olecranon bursitis? Similar conditions can affect the lower extremity, jumper knee, or popliteal bursitis. Because bursa are located in direct proximity to tendons, inflammation of one can mimic that of the other, causing nearly identical pain in the same parts of the body. How do you determine the culprit? On this episode, we will discuss the common types of tendonitis and bursitis, differentiating them as we go. Part 1. Tendons and bursa. Both tendons and bursa play crucial roles in the musculoskeletal system. They allow us to go about our daily activities and maintain normal, active range of motion in our bodies. Like any structures in the body, tendons and bursa can be irritated, inflamed, or injured. Tendonitis and bursitis are often confused because they can present with similar symptoms. Both involve inflammation of soft tissue associated with muscle and bone, but they target different types of tissues. Tendons are tough bands of fibrous tissue composed of collagen that attaches muscles to bones. They provide stability and modulate movement. Bursa are the small jelly-like sacs located within joints to serve to cushion, lubricate, and reduce friction between bones and soft tissue. Part 2. Understanding common forms of tendonitis. The human body contains more than 600 muscle tendon units. When any of these areas become inflamed or irritated, we call it tendonitis. Although the suffix itis generally refers to an inflammatory process, the term is often used loosely when it comes to tendonitis. Technically speaking, it's more accurate to use the term tendinopathy, because there is often little or no evidence of inflammation found on histology. Tendonitis and tendinopathy are often used interchangeably in common language. How common is tendonitis? The simple answer is very common. According to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, more than 70,000 people miss work each year because of tendonitis. Tendonitis typically develops in the shoulder or rotator cuff, elbow, Achilles tendon, and long head of the biceps tendon in the lower arm. It can be either acute or chronic. When there is sudden injury or force exerted on a tendon, commonly during participating in sports like soccer, field hockey, or long-distance running, we get acute tendonitis. An improper landing, awkward twist, or fall can lead to a sudden tear or rupture of the Achilles tendon, which is a prime example of acute tendonitis. In comparison, chronic tendonitis may be the result of rheumatoid arthritis or repetitive stress over a long period of time. For example, a distance runner who has worn out their shoes and continues to wear shoes lacking support can cause repetitive stress on the patellar tendon, leading to chronic tendonitis. Let's pause for a quiz. What are the common sites for tendonitis to develop? Tendonitis often occurs in the rotator cuff, elbow, Achilles tendon, and long head of the biceps tendon. Certain tendons in the body are more commonly affected by tendonitis because we tend to heavily use them in day-to-day life, especially those who perform physical labor or lead active lifestyles. Let's take a look at two commonly occurring forms of tendonitis, starting with rotator cuff tendonitis. It is one of the most common causes of shoulder pain. Patients classically present with shoulder pain that worsens with overhead activities or with lying down on the affected shoulder. As we know from anatomy, the rotator cuff is made up of a group of four muscles that help stabilize and move the shoulder joint. The supraspinatus, which is a small muscle of the upper back that runs from the supraspinous fossa superior portion of the scapula, also known as the shoulder blade, to the greater tubercle of the humerus, is also accompanied by the infraspinatus, teres minor, and subscapularis. In rotator cuff injuries, the supraspinatus muscle and tendon are the most common sites for a tear. It is most common in sports that involve elevation of the arm, like swimming, weightlifting, and pitching, like in baseball. Diagnosis is primarily made through history and physical examination. The patient may have pain on shoulder motion, especially flexing and abducting the arm or any arm motion above the head. This is reproduced on exam. There is sometimes mild swelling in the anterior shoulder, but this is not required for diagnosis. In a cuff tear, it is suspected but less obvious. Imaging can be used to assist in evaluation. Magnetic resonance imaging, also known as MRI, and ultrasound are both used. MRI is the most accurate and precise imaging modality for the rotator cuff tears. It will appear as a separation of white tissue just superior to the humeral head. MRI can be costly, time-consuming, and even anxiety-provoking for patients who are claustrophobic. Instead of ordering an MRI, physicians often begin with ultrasound, which is both non-invasive and cost-effective, to rapidly but accurately diagnose a cuff tear. If ultrasound is not definitive, MRI can be done. Here's another quiz. What is the most accurate imaging modality to diagnose rotator cuff tendonitis? MRI gives the best accuracy for the diagnosis of rotator cuff tendonitis. Acute rotator cuff tendonitis is often treated with rest, ice, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs or NSAIDs, and physical therapy. Symptoms improve for many patients over the course of 6 to 12 months from these measures. Steroid injections can also be attempted to provide temporary symptom relief. Conservative therapy is helpful in many cases, but sometimes severe tendonitis can progress to a rotator cuff tear. Surgical repair of an acute rotator cuff tear is usually recommended for patients who have only felt minimal relief from the conservative measures. Patients are encouraged to try physical therapy for 6 to 12 months before considering surgery. In addition, surgery is less beneficial for sedentary patients with comorbidities that already limit their activity. However, rotator cuff surgery can greatly improve an active patient's quality of life. Arthroscopic or open surgery can be performed to release the space between the underside of the acromion and the affected tendon, which reduces irritation to the tendon during shoulder movements. Now let's shift to lateral epicondylitis. Lateral epicondylitis is also known as tennis elbow. It's not a true inflammation, but rather a stress injury to the tendon and muscle where it inserts onto the humerus. So, some clinicians prefer to call it tendinosis or tendinopathy instead. Certainly, the backhand stroke of a tennis swing is one motion that can trigger the condition, but many people have it that have never set foot on a tennis court. Anyone who performs repetitive wrist extension is at risk for lateral epicondylitis. Painters, plumbers, musicians, and carpenters are especially prone to this overuse injury. A patient typically describes burning muscle in the lateral forearm and elbow, along with pain and decreased strength during gripping. Although not as common as tennis elbow, the related golfer elbow, medial epicondylitis, is due to repetitive wrist flexion, such as during forehand golf shots. It affects tendons inserting on the medial epicondyle of the humerus and causes medial elbow pain. Diagnosis of lateral epicondylitis is usually clinical and based on presentation, history, and physical examination findings. Imaging typically is not required. On examination, patients have point tenderness 1 to 2 centimeters distal to where the extensor carpi radialis brevis, or ECRB muscle, inserts into the lateral epicondyle of the elbow. One way to evaluate a patient for lateral epicondylitis is with the Cozen test. To perform this test, you position the patient's hand in pronation and radial deviation. If resisting wrist extension in this position produces pain around the lateral epicondyle, the test result is positive. There are many treatments for lateral epicondylitis. More common ones include NSAIDs, steroid injections, acupuncture, or botulinum injection. Less common treatments include ionotrophoresis, that's using voltage stimulation to deliver medications through the skin, platelet-rich plasma injections, autologous blood injections, and extracorporeal shockwave. Surgery is only considered after medical therapies have failed to help the patient for a prolonged period of at least 6 to 12 months. It involves release and debridement of the ECRB muscle at its origin. Let's stop for another quiz. What does a positive Cozen test indicate? A positive Cozen test indicates lateral epicondylitis. There is pain in the area of the lateral epicondyle with resisted wrist extension. Part 3. Understanding the common forms of bursitis. Bursitis refers to an inflammation or irritation affecting the joint's bursa. As in tendonitis, bursitis can be acute or chronic. Bursitis is most commonly caused by repetitive motions and positions that cause pressure on the bursa, as well as by trauma and infection. Unlike tendonitis, on histology, bursitis usually shows inflammatory cells, such as neutrophils, macrophages, and lymphocytes, which help sequester and clear debris and damaged cells. The most common sites of bursitis include the shoulder, elbow, hip, and knee. However, bursitis can be seen in the heel and base of the big toe, which is associated with gout or rheumatoid arthritis. People depend on the movement of these major joints to walk, handle objects, and go about their daily lives. The bursa in these joints help with lubrication and assist with full range of joint movement. Like any other structure, bursa can also become injured, irritated, or inflamed. Here's a quiz. What would you expect to see, histologically, on a slide of bursitis? Inflammatory cells such as neutrophils, macrophages, and lymphocytes would be seen on histological examination of bursitis. Let's focus on a few of these common forms of bursitis. Of the several bursa in the shoulder, the most commonly inflamed is the subacromial bursa, located between the acromion and the rotator cuff tendons. The inflammation is usually the result of impingement from overhead activities like swimming. Less commonly, it is caused by infection, autoimmune inflammation, as in rheumatoid arthritis, or crystal deposition, as in gout. It presents as shoulder pain, which can be gradual or sudden in onset, and is generally worse at night. Subacromial bursitis can mimic rotator cuff injuries and must be differentiated using a physical examination. When the cause of shoulder pain is subacromial bursitis, there is usually pain on arm abduction, particularly between 80 degrees and 120 degrees. Ultrasound, the preferred imaging technique, may reveal bursa fluid distension and wall thickening. MRI reveals increased fluid within the bursa. Treatment of subacromial bursitis is generally with conservative management, like rest, physical therapy, and NSAIDs. If conservative measures fail, minimally invasive endoscopic surgery can be considered to remove the affected bursa. Olecranon bursitis is a condition characterized by pain, swelling, and erythema at the tip or extensor surface of the elbow. Common occurrences are from prolonged pressure, like leaning on a hard surface for an extended period, an underlying autoimmune condition like rheumatoid arthritis or gout, or infection from a simple bug bite to a puncture wound, which permits bacterial entry. In infectious bursitis, staphylococci or streptococci are the most common offending organisms. Diagnosis is based on physical exam, which may include elbow swelling, pain, and if infected, erythema and warmness to the touch. If infection is suspected, a fluid sample should be taken from the affected bursa and sent for Gram stain and culture to determine the infectious agent. Microscopy can also be used to look for the presence of crystals, which can suggest non-infectious causes like gout or pseudogout. White blood cell counts may or may not be elevated, and infection cannot be ruled out even if white blood cell counts are normal. Management is vastly different depending on the cause of the bursitis, so it is important to consider infectious versus non-infectious causes and how each is treated. Depending on the etiology, treatment can vary. Many non-infectious causes of olecranon bursitis resolve with the time and supportive care. This includes treating the pain with NSAIDs, rest, ice, and perhaps steroid injection. If swelling does not subside after 3 to 6 weeks, then removing fluid from the bursa may be recommended for the patient's comfort. Underlying etiologies such as rheumatoid arthritis or gout should be treated with appropriate anti-inflammatory drugs, usually starting with NSAIDs. Of course, if the bursa is infected, antibiotics are the ideal treatment. For methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus, initial coverage may include clindamycin, doxycycline, or trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole, and then adjusted when the bursa culture results return. How about another quiz? When are antibiotics indicated in the treatment of bursitis? When infection is suspected, antibiotics should be initiated and the bursa should be aspirated. Let's discuss popliteal bursitis. Popliteal bursitis, also known as Baker's cyst, named after the doctor William Morant Baker, not pastry chefs. They are fluid-filled cysts located behind the knee. patients with bursitis generally present with a feeling of tightness. Common causes are similar to those of olecranon bursitis. It could be trauma or sports-related injuries, gout or rheumatoid arthritis, and osteoarthritis. These conditions can lead to increased fluid production and the formation of an intra-articular cyst. Sometimes, the cysts rupture, producing pain, swelling, stiffness, and bruising on the back of the knee and calf. The pain might get worse with full knee extension or increased activity. Diagnosis is based on physical exam, which reveals posterior swelling that is most apparent when standing. Imaging can be used if the diagnosis is uncertain. Ultrasound is both non-invasive and cost-effective, so it is the first choice. On an ultrasound, you would observe a pocket of fluid seen in the popliteal region, again known as Baker's cyst. If ultrasound results are not definitive, then MRI of the joint can be obtained to gather further information or plan surgery, because MRI provides higher anatomical resolution. Treatment is usually not required because popliteal bursitis is not dangerous and tends to improve with time. Primary supportive measures include rest, ice, and NSAIDs or steroid injection for pain. If symptoms persist, needle aspiration or surgical excision may be indicated. Let's pause for a quiz. What can cause popliteal bursitis to develop? Trauma or injury to the knee can cause fluid to accumulate behind the knee joint. Inflammation can also precipitate fluid production, leading to Baker cyst formation. And that brings us to the end of our discussion on tendonitis and bursitis. Now, let's recap to see if we've completed our goals. First, can you define tendonitis and bursitis and discuss their differences? Remember that tendons are tough bands of fibrous tissue composed of collagen that attach muscles to bones. And bursa are the small jelly-like sacs located within joints that serve to cushion, lubricate, and reduce friction between bones and soft tissue. When a tendon or bursa are irritated or inflamed, we generally describe them as tendonitis and bursitis, respectively. Second, can you name the two common forms of tendonitis? Rotator cuff tendonitis and lateral epicondylitis, also known as tennis elbow, are the most common types of tendonitis. The Achilles tendon and the long head of the biceps tendon in the lower arm also commonly suffer from tendonitis. Third and finally, can you name three common forms of bursitis? Shoulder bursitis, olecranon bursitis, and popliteal, also known as Baker cysts, are the three common forms of bursitis. And that's it. Armed with your newfound knowledge of tendonitis and bursitis, let's get back to the patient from the beginning of this episode. You are an internal medicine resident, and your roommate comes to you complaining of pain in her right leg. She has her leg elevated, and you observe a tense red swelling overlying her kneecap. You are concerned that she most likely has prepatellar bursitis. You explain to your roommate that the bursa, which normally cushions her knee, likely got inflamed from kneeling on the hard floors for a prolonged time. You tell her that these usually resolve with conservative treatment, but sometimes needle aspiration is needed. She says, "No needles!" You decide to watch it tonight, ice it, take NSAIDs, and see how it is tomorrow. You both jokingly agree that knee pads might be an option for a job like this in the future. Make sure you like and subscribe on Apple Podcasts if you liked what you heard. Remember, your feedback helps us to improve. And again, now your chance to take advantage of the Brick Season Pass offer by following the link in the show notes below. It's a huge discount on written material that serves as the foundation of Audio Bricks. complete with illustrations, questions, flashcards, and active learning. So go check that out if you haven't already, and help keep audiobooks free.